The God of Joseph's fathers was a God of the Spirit. At least, that was the goal of his evolution, for the sake of which he had made a bond with men. Never since he united with theirs his will to salvation had he anything to do with death and the netherworld, or with any madness rooted in the dark bottom of fruitfulness. In man, he had become aware that such things were an abomination unto him, and in his turn, man too had become aware of it in him. Joseph, when he said his good nights to the dying Montcalm, had of course dealt soothingly with his death anguish, and told him how it would be with him in the hereafter, saying consolingly that they would be together forever and always, because they belonged together in their sagas. But that was a friendly concession to human distress, a benevolent open-mindedness, which for the moment looked aside from what he knew to be fixed, from the strict and stern renunciation of any view of the hereafter, which had been the way the fathers and their self-sanctifying God took to make, by such a ruling, a clear divorce between themselves and the corpse gods of their neighbors in their temple graves and their death rigidity. For only by comparison does man distinguish and learn what he is in order to become what he should be. Thus, the famous chastity of Joseph, a future husband and father, was no theoretic and self-flagellating denial of the sphere of love and procreation, which would have been inconsistent with the promise to Abraham that his seed should be numerous as the desert sand. Rather, it was the inherited dictate of his blood to uphold the godly claims of reason in this field, and to avoid all horned folly and aula saucaula, which in his mind formed an inseparable logical and metaphysical unity with the service of the dead. It was Moot's misfortune that he saw in her wooing a temptation from this complex of death and unchastity, the temptation of Sheol, to yield to which would have meant laying himself bare to annihilation. Here we have the seventh and last reason, the last also in the sense that it comprehended all the others, for altogether what they came to was just this fear, the fear of laying himself bare. That was what he heard when Moot had tried to divest their conversation of the fig leaf of objectivity. But we must consider it here in the sober light of its manifold sense-reference and the vast scope of its consequences. How strangely it can fare with the meaning of a word when it breaks up into its elements in the mind, as a ray of light from a cloud is broken up into the colors of the rainbow. Let even one of these refractions make unhappy contact with an evil association and become a curse, and it loses its good repute in all. It becomes an abomination in every one of its senses, so that it can be and is condemned to be used solely to characterize abominations. If red, let us say, is a bad color, the color of the desert, the color of the polar star, then it is all over with the blithe innocence of the whole white ray of heaven. The idea of barrenness and bearing did not originally lack innocence and blitheness. It had no red about it, and no curse. But since the accursed affair of Noah in his tent, with Ham and Kenan, his wicked son, it got, so to speak, a permanent split, became red and evil in this refraction, and blushed through and through. There was nothing else to do after that but to use it to describe abominations. It even happened that every abomination, or almost all, cried out for this name, and recognized itself in it. In the attitude of the anxious Jacob by the well, almost 9 years before, when he sternly rebuked his son for the nakedness with which he responded to the loveliness of the moon, in that attitude lay a regrettable blackening of an idea in itself as bright as the sight of a naked boy by a well. Bearing, in the simple and literal physical sense, was in the beginning quite unsuspect. It was as neutral as the light of heaven. It only began to blush when it acquired a transferred significance as Baal folly and the shameful blood sin of looking upon the nakedness of a father. But now the redness had reflected back upon the innocent original meaning and cast such a glow upon it that it became a name for every sort of deadly sin, those actually committed and those only realized in look and wish, so that finally everything forbidden, thought of as accursed in the realm of sensual lust and fleshly intercourse, and especially by association with the shame of Noah, the invasion of the son into the rights of the father, was thought of as bearing. And even that was not all, for a new and peculiar association and comparison grew up, and the error of Reuben, the offense done by the son to the father's bed, began to stand for the whole conception, until every meeting of glances, every wish, every act, became almost equivalent in quality and even name to a shaming of the father. These, then, whether we like it or not, were the pictures in Joseph's mind. To do that to which the Sphinx of this dead land incited him seemed to him a shaming of his father. And was it not, in truth, when we remember what wickedness the land of mud meant to the old man at home, and with what outraged alarm he would have learned that his child, instead of being safely garnered up in death, was living in such sore temptation? In those anxious brown eyes with the soft tear glands beneath, Joseph could feel them resting upon him, he would be committing that sinful bearing of himself, forgetting himself as grossly as Reuben had done. What time he had shown himself unstable as water and been deprived of the blessing. Since then, the blessing had hovered over Joseph's head. Should he, too, be unstable and fling it away by sporting with this dubious cat goddess, as Reuben once had sported with Bilhah? Who can wonder that his inward answer to the question was, "Not for the world"? Who, I repeat, can be surprised, considering all the associations and identifications bound up in Joseph's mind with the idea of his father and the thought of offending him? Can even the liveliest mind, or the person most receptive to the tender passion, find anything strange in a chastity which consisted in a resolution counseled by the purest religious prudence, namely, that he would avoid the grossest error he could commit and the one most injurious to his future prospects? These, then, were the seven reasons why Joseph desired not to respond to the call of his mistress's blood, not for anything in the world. I have set them down in the order of their number and weight, and regard them with a certain sense of reassurance, which, however, considering the hour at which we have arrived, is by no means in place, since Joseph is still enduring temptation, and as the story tells itself, there was as yet no certainty whether he would come out of it a whole man or not. He did come well out of it, that is, he escaped with a black eye, as we know. But why did he venture so far? Why did he disregard the whispered warning of his pure-hearted little friend, who already saw the pit yawning, and make friends instead with the phallic-minded mannequin who played Lothario and mumbled out of the corner of his mouth? In a word, why did he not avoid the mistress, instead of letting things reach the pass they did for him and for her? Yes, that was coquetting with the world. It was sympathy with the forbidden thing. It was also a falling away from the death name he had chosen and from the state of salvation in which he had stood. And it had a savor of arrogant self-assurance, of a notion that he could venture into danger and retreat whenever he liked. To look at it on its good side, it was a willingness to take a dare, the ambition to face the worst and run the risk, to push matters to the utmost in order to carry off a greater triumph, to be a virtuoso of virtue, and thus more precious to the father than a more restricted and an easier trial would have shown him. Perhaps, even, it was a secret knowledge of his own course and the line it took, the suspicion that its next lesser round was to complete itself and bring him to the pit, which was inevitable if all that was to be fulfilled which was written in the plan.